dear friend of Orzaru already because of his work with Chavruta class here. Before that, because we made a sukkah in Jerusalem years ago. And,
you know, I still keep that picture on my desk. I have a picture of us in the sukkah, yeah.
There's a great amount of depth in Morty's Talmudic teaching of Jewish law, halacha, to rabbinical students. He taught them, how many years has it been now at the seminary?
I came in as the admissions director in 2007.
Yeah. Nearly a decade. And has taught classes at Hebrew Union College and around the country and globally. And his book about rewriting the Talmud is about to come out. It's at the typesetter. And it compares Bavli and Yerushalmi traditions.
Yeah.
And talks about why they're so close, yet so far away. And so a little bit of that we did the last time when you were here, when we had one of these scholarly takes on the holidays we did before the high holidays, and now it's Hanukkah. And so we're looking forward to tonight's shiur, Morty, and great that you're back at Orzaru.
It's really great to be here. It's really great to be here. It's nice to see familiar faces and also to see some new people here. It's really fantastic. So I want to tell you a little bit about this piece before I start. You know that last time that I was here, I brought some examples from the book that I have currently coming out, that, as he mentioned, is with the typesetters right now. It's going to be a bestseller, believe me. But this piece that I'm going to share part of with you tonight, is a piece I've been working on for about 3.5 years or so, and I'm hoping to develop it into a larger article. Obviously, I had to cut down some of the ideas here, and so as a result, there are only 6 pages of sources. I could have given you a packet of 30 pages, but I decided to be kind. Basically, this started when I realized, I think it was 3 years ago that we had Thanksgivingka, right? Mm-hmm. Or where we had Hanukkah and Thanksgiving at the same time, and I became interested in the idea of Hanukkah as Thanksgiving. And that year I actually really focused it in that direction. What is the relationship between Hanukkah and the American holiday of Thanksgiving? There are traces of that still here. We're going to see, eventually get there. There's some very interesting connections between Hanukkah and Thanksgiving. But this has become a larger project now. As you know, the major mitzvah of Hanukkah is lighting the candles. But there is a second mitzvah that is actually associated with Hanukkah. Actually, it is a mitzvah that is associated not only with Hanukkah, but is associated with Sukkot also. You may or may not know that that second Maccabees actually does connect the festival of Sukkot with the festival of Hanukkah, making the claim that that Hanukkah is instituted kind of as a replacement for, or as a tashlumin. How do you say tashlumin? We say like a recompense, yeah. So in other words, a makeup for having missed Sukkot that year, right? The temple was taken over by Antiochus Epiphanes, and therefore they were unable to bring all of the sacrifices on Sukkot. So there's a mitzvah that's actually in common between Hanukkah and Sukkot. So here's how I'm going to put it. There are 3 mitzvot on Sukkot, and there are 2 mitzvot on Hanukkah. If you look in Rambam's Mishnah Torah, he'll tell you exactly that. So, what are the 3 mitzvot of Sukkot? The Levinetrig is one. Okay, sitting and dwelling in the Sukkah is the second. So those are the 2 major ones. Now there's a third one that nobody thinks about. Well, no, that's the first one. The Sukkah is the second one. Okay? So then, no, building a sukkah actually, interestingly, is not a mitzvah. It is a hechsher mitzvah. How do I know that building a sukkah is not a mitzvah? Because you do it before Sukkot. You see what I mean? Right? It is a prerequisite to the mitzvah. So the way that this would work is if I tie tzitzit onto a 4-cornered garment, am I performing a mitzvah? Answer is no, I'm not. The mitzvah is only when you have tzitzit on a four-cornered garment and then you wear that four-cornered garment. That's when the mitzvah occurs. So it's what's called a hechsher mitzvah. It's the preparation necessary for completing a mitzvah. And the same thing is actually true about the sukkah, and the Talmud itself already makes that comparison. So okay, so fine. So we have three mitzvot, right? And we have two mitzvot on Hanukkah. One of those mitzvot is the same. Now the reason that you can't think about it, that you can't recall what that mitzvah is because it takes place only in the synagogue, right? And it's something that seems to you, although this is not true, it seems to you also occurs every Rosh Chodesh.
Hallel.
Right. Except of course that Hallel isn't said on Rosh Chodesh, right? Because we say the half Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. Whenever you say the half Hallel, you're not really saying Hallel, right? You understand how that works, right? So what's Hallel? Hallel is it is Psalms 113 through 118. They're a unit that are recited in the synagogue on particularly joyous days. It's recited on the first day of Pesach. It's recited on Sukkot. It's recited on Hanukkah. We'll see a source in here later on about that. What's the point of Hallel? What am I doing by reciting Hallel? That's right. What is the central text of Hallel? Hodu Adonai Ki Tov, Ki Lo Olam Chasdo, right? Give thanks to the Lord. Right? For he is good. Kilo lam chasto, for his mercy endures forever. Right? So in other words, this idea of thanksgiving is inherent in Hallel. And that is the mitzvah that we actually have, this additional mitzvah that we have on both Hanukkah and Sukkot. The thing about Sukkot that differentiates it from Pesach is that on Sukkot you recite Hallel every single day, the way we do it on Pesach today, in our time, and for that matter since the time of the Babylonian Talmud, is that we recite the full Hallel on the first day, or first days of Pesach in the diaspora, and then all the other days it's a half Hallel. And so the question becomes, well, what's going on? Why is it that we're only really thankful for the first days of Pesach, and then our thanks is diminished during the remainder of Pesach, and why is it that on Sukkot and on Hanukkah there's this special need for thanksgiving? That's really the central question. And in a lot of ways, this talk that I'm giving tonight is an attempt to sort of answer that question, to figure out what's going on in thanks. Now, there's another time when that's a regular. Usually it's done in the synagogue today, but that is a regular ritual for giving thanks for things that happen in an individual's life. You've probably seen this in synagogue. Someone gets up to the Torah, they get an aliyah, right? They make a bracha, an additional bracha after the aliyah, and then everyone repeats a phrase back in Hebrew. Have people seen this?
Gomel.
So right, exactly. Benching Gomel. Right. So different synagogues have different customs, but in fact the idea of benching Gomel, that's something that's also about Thanksgiving as well. Now the interesting thing about this is that there are brachot that are associated with times in our lives when we have encountered miraculous salvation, right? So the idea of Birkat Gomel is that I have encountered danger, I've been saved, and now I'm thanking God. Now, what is the actual text of the bracha? Right? HaGomel L'chayavim Tovot Shigamalani Kol Tov. Right? We bless God for being the one who saves those who are actually liable for death, who are deserving of death. Because for you have saved me. In other words, the idea is that God gives grace, abundant grace, you know, more amazing grace, right? More than what we deserve. In fact, the idea is that I am deserving of death for my sins, and yet God has saved me. Me, this unworthy person. And then the whole congregation says, the one who saved you this time, let him save you again, right? And that's actually the ritual of Gomel. But what you may not know is there's also another ritual. The next time you're in that place where you were saved, right, you're also supposed to recite a bracha, which is actually really interesting, right? So there is a bracha, and this bracha is going to sound very familiar to you, right? So we'll get there. There is a bracha, and you'll see what I don't want to give everything away right at the beginning. But in any case, those are all the conceptual pieces, and they're all surrounding Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving in terms of myself being saved. Thanksgiving in terms of Hallel. Thanksgiving in terms of Gomel, and then Thanksgiving additionally in terms of Hanukkah itself. And my claim is that there's going to be a bracha that's associated with Hanukkah that actually is about this whole notion of Thanksgiving that actually is recited at the kindling of the Hanukkah lights as well. So you're going to see all of these things together, and the question is, how do we sort through all these things? These things are clearly related in some way. How do we understand how this complex of Thanksgiving functions? And then how do we understand the energy that puts into the festival of Hanukkah, right? On the one hand, we think of Hanukkah as either a military victory, or we think about it as Persuma de Nisa, that it's a publication of some kind of a miracle or a publicization of a kind of a miracle. But I think we're less used to thinking about it in terms of this idea of Thanksgiving, which is, I think, really, really, really central to the themes that we see here. So let's go ahead and take a look at these texts, and you'll see a little bit of what I'm talking about. By the way, are there questions before I move on? Okay, fantastic. So let's go ahead and go to this first Mishnah. This is from Mishnah Brachot 9.1. Do I have a reader, I guess is the question. Do I want to just go around maybe over here? Are there objections if we start over here? Go ahead. So please go ahead.
Mishnah Brachot 9.1.
Yeah.
When it is a place where miracles were done for Israel, should say, blessed is the one who did miracles for our fathers in this place. A place that had idol worship uprooted from it, one says. Blessed is the one who uprooted idol worship from our land.
Great, fantastic. So, in other words, there's a notion here that, in fact, Thanksgiving needs to be done or given for a place when one arrives at a place in which miracles were done for one's ancestors. So if you actually look at the text of the bracha here, right, it should already sound somewhat familiar to you. If I say it in Hebrew, it's going to sound even more familiar. Baruch she'asa nisim lavotenu b'makom hazeh. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Yeah, what does it sound like? Yeah, exactly right. So what's the difference between makom and yamim? What does yamim mean versus what does makom mean? So yamim means those days, right? Right? Bayamim ha'hem bazman hazeh. And those days at this time, or at this season is really what zman means. And here what we're doing is we're replacing the idea of time with space, by entering into that space where the salvation occurred in some ancient time, you actually are required to say a bracha. You're required to acknowledge and to give thanks. So what's an example of a place where one would have to make this bracha? Not a rhetorical question. So good. So in other words, you could in fact have a personal mitzvah if in fact you had drowned on the beach, you would then say Baruch she'asa li nes b'makom hazeh. That's actually what the Talmud records. Blessed is the one who did a miracle for me in this place, and you are required to say that. But if you're talking about a place in which a miracle was done for your ancestor, what is an example of that kind of a place? The Red Sea, the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Right now, you're probably thinking of the Six-Day War, right?
No.
Oh, no, you're not. You're thinking of
when the temples.
Right, so that's actually interesting, right? The problem with the temple is that the temple was actually destroyed, right? So you could say that in the time of the Hasmoneans, when you got to the temple, you would say, well, God saved the temple. The problem with that, of course, is that the temple is now in destruction. So there's this kind of, you know, cognitive dissonance that's going on. But I think the Red Sea is a really good example. Why the Red Sea?
Because the miracle happened.
Yeah, namely the splitting of the sea, right? Exactly, the exodus from Egypt. I think that's fantastic, and that's actually an example that the Talmud gives. Are there other thoughts about this? Other examples of miracles? The walls of Jericho. That's another example that the Talmud actually gets. If when you visit Jericho, you're required to make this bracha there as well, right? What if you visit Persia? You visit Iran. You go to the city of Susa in Iran, right? Which is Shushan, right? So then, what are you supposed to do there? Probably you're supposed to make a bracha there as well, which is actually very, very interesting. You can actually go there, by the way, and see the tomb of Mordechai and Esther. I'm sure that's the actual historical tomb. But there is a tomb there that's supposed to be the tomb of Mordechai and Esther there in Susa, in Persia. Yeah, in Iran.
Why are you characterizing this as Thanksgiving? It says Baruch. I would think that there would be distinct language if you're going to characterize it.
So in other words, how do we thank? You're saying that it needs to have the root hey Dalet hey,
unless
right?
You're saying every blessing is Thanksgiving.
Right. So probably although I would think that that's the case with regard to brachot that acknowledge phenomenon. In other words, there are two kinds of brachot that we actually have, right? On the one hand, there's a bracha that I say before I take benefit from something, right? I'm about to eat an apple. Right, so I say Baruch Borei Pri Ha'Eitz. Blessed is the one who made the fruit of the tree, and then I eat the apple, and presumably that's some kind of like a desacralization ritual, right? The apple belongs to God, and by praising God or thanking God for the apple, if you want to put it that way, I then remove it from the divine realm to the human realm. But then there are other kinds of brachot where I actually see a sight, and I praise God for having created that sight. And that's what the Rambam calls a birkat hashavach, a blessing of praise, right? So if I see the ocean, and I haven't seen it in the past 6 months, right? I say Baruch she'asa et hayam hagadol, right? Blessed is the one who made the great sea, right? And presumably that's true originally of the Mediterranean, and there's actually a dispute amongst the Acharonim, I guess you would say. How do you say Acharonim? The early modern scholars.
The opposite of the Rishonim.
Yeah, the opposite of the Rishonim, right. The most recent of scholars, of course, they're no longer the most recent. They're from about the 16th through the late 19th century. About whether or not it only applies to the Mediterranean, or if you're at the Atlantic or the Pacific, do you also make that bracha?
Why couldn't these be characterized as Shavach and not Todana?
So they probably are Shavach. The thing that's fascinating about Shavach is that all Shavach contains thanks, all praise contains thanks, and all thanks contains praise, right? If you actually stop and you think about it, when you're thanking someone for having done something for you, you actually are at the same time praising them. I think that that the question becomes, when you thank someone, what's your position vis-a-vis that person? Is that person superior to you, or are you inferior to that person, or are you superior to that person? In other words, there's a level of condescension that a superior when they give thanks to an inferior person. In this case, so when you're, God is obviously always going to be superior, so the question becomes, well, what are you doing? Presumably at the time that you're giving thanks, you're also giving praise, right? If you think about the bracha of Modim and the Amidah, you actually talk about God's miracles, which are with us every day, right? So that's Erev Avoker B'Tzoraim, right? Morning, noon, and night. So is that purely thanks, or is that also praise? And the same thing's true, by the way, in the praise business, right? Umekayim emunato lishenei afar, right? God keeps his faith with those who lie in the dust, right? So is that thanks? Probably that's thanks also, right? It's an expectation of resurrection, and therefore thanks. So every praise contains thanks, and every
distinct sort of body of blessing.
Well, so it's very complex.
Now you just blurred the lines.
Well, that's what I love to do.
Okay.
So I'm always blurring lines. And I don't think that these categories are actually as distinct as we think they are. So that's probably, I don't know if that's a satisfying answer, but it is an answer, let's say it that way. Okay, so fine. So the main thing that I wanted you to see here, although I think the idol worship business is actually really fascinating as well. Baruch she'akar avodah zarah me'artzeinu. Presumably you would only say, blessed is the one who has removed idol worship from our land. When you're in the land of Israel, and outside of the land of Israel, presumably that means that idol worship is permissible, at least for non-Jews. which is interesting also. The first part was really what I wanted you to see, which was the similarity, the amazing similarity of this bracha, Baruch Sha'asa Nisim Lavotenu B'Makom Hazeh. Right? So that's a little bit of a reveal. And we'll talk and see if this idea carries through. So let's now take a look at the material that's in Shabbat. We'll move down one here, and we're going to see what we can make of this. Okay, go ahead.
Rabbi Chaya Ba'ashi said that Rav said,
mm-hmm.
One who lights the Hanukkah light must make a blessing, but Rav, your Maya, said one who sees the Hanukkah light must make a blessing.
Okay, so what's the difference between them? Right, so one says you have to make a blessing when you do what?
Light it, and the other one says when you see it.
Right, so in other words, what happens? I'm walking out on the street right after it gets dark, it's during Hanukkah, and I see somebody's menorah in their window. Do I have to make a bracha, or do I not have to make a bracha? According, right, exactly right. So according to Rav Yirmiyah, that's when you would make the bracha. Okay? So we're going to now try and see. So it seems like they're in dispute, right? It seems like Chiya Bar Ashi is reporting Rav's tradition that, in fact, the only time you make the bracha is if you're actually the one lighting it. But Rav Yirmiyah says even if you're not lighting it, presumably he also if you're lighting it, because you're seeing it when you light it, you understand what I mean by that, right? But it does feel like there's a dispute between the two of them, and Rav is limiting it to lighting. Everyone agree with me? Anyone want to dispute that?
Just if you lived in a Jewish neighborhood, you'd be blessing a lot.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Right, exactly right. So how many times are you gonna actually make the bracha? That's an interesting question. Rav Yehuda, on the other hand, wants to try and harmonize these two positions. So why don't you read Rav Yehuda for us?
Rav Yehuda said, on the first day, the one who sees it makes two blessings, and the one who lights makes three blessings. From here on out, the one who lights blesses two blessings, and the one who sees blesses one blessing.
Yeah, okay, so fine. So now, this is going to be a little bit, this is an attempt to harmonize, and we're going to try and figure out what the heck is going on. If you light it, you say two brachot on most days, except on the first day when you say three. Okay, so what are the three brachot? You've all seen this, right? Hadlik Ner Shel Hanukkah. By the way, I just want to say this. The fact that you said the Hadlik Ner Shel Shabbat is very interesting, because the bracha, the Hadlik Ner Shel Shabbat, does not actually appear in the Talmud. Right.
It came after Hanukkah.
Right, that's exactly right. In other words, the Hanukkah blessing was borrowed when in the early Middle Ages, the Gaonim said, well, we should really be making a bracha on Hanukkah lights too. Clearly people were lighting them. Shabbos lights, yeah. Clearly people were lighting Shabbos lights during the time of the Talmud. There's a whole chapter about that. This is actually the second chapter it's talking about, but they weren't probably making a bracha. So the bracha from Hanukkah is borrowed for Shabbat. It actually does appear in terms of, and we're going to see that in a second. Yeah, so fine. So exactly right. So the first one is Lahadlik Ner Shel Hanukkah. What's the second one?
Sha'asa Nisim.
Sha'asa Nisim, right, who did miracles for our ancestors, right, in that time, at this season. And the third one?
Shehiyanu.
Great. So that's now the next question then becomes, right, Rav Yehuda says, that's the one who lights. Now the one who sees, that person apparently is also going to make brachot, but they're going to be fewer brachot. On the first night they're going to make two, and on subsequent nights they're only going to make one. Which one do you think they're leaving out? Hadlik Ner. I think you're exactly with me, which is very interesting, because this means, and we're going to see the Talmud confirm in a second exactly what you're saying, but what this means is that there's a quality of brachot that's different between them, right? The first one, Asher Kedishanu B'Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu, who's commanded us with his commandments, who has made us sacred with his commandments, commanding us to do what? To light the lights. That's a Birkat HaMitzvah. That's something that you're doing prior to doing a mitzvah. But apparently the second bracha is about seeing the light. And you only make it once you see the light, and therefore it's in the category of kind of a birkat hashavach. You see what I mean? And it's much akin to the idea of going into a place where a miracle was done for your ancestors. Except now we're going into a time when a miracle was done for your ancestors. which is really very interesting. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a look and see this confirmed. So please continue on.
Which does he omit?
Right, which bracha does he omit? Yeah?
He omits one.
Yeah, so the Talmud always calls, the Zman is what the Talmud calls Shechianu. We call it Shechianu. But actually, Shechianu became Manaviganu Lazman Hazeh, right? In other words, what the point is that we've made it to this season, right? Shechianu means who has kept us alive, right? Zman means season. So which one do you call it? The Talmud always calls it Zman. It's also shorter, by the way. Wouldn't it be nice if we called it Zman instead of Shechianu? My mother can never actually say Shechianu. She has trouble saying it. She's never sure which one is the hay and which one is the chet. Okay, so let's go ahead and keep.
Let us omit the miracle blessing.
Yeah. Okay. So fine. So now the question is, well, why should I say that I'm going to omit Shechianu? Why should I say that I should omit Shechianu? Let me in fact say that every single day I'm lighting a new light. Right, and so it's a new thing every single day, and what I should leave out is the fact that it's a miracle, right? Because I already said miracle on the first day, right? So what is the answer to that?
It was a part of the miracle every
day. Yeah, I don't like that translation so much. This is pulled off of Svaria, and it's like hit or miss with these translations because they have their open source translations. That means anyone off the street can kind of like contribute to these translations. So I don't think that this is saying Nes Kol Yoma Ite actually just means there was a miracle every single day. Obviously, this is referring to the story of the oil, that the oil lasted for 8 days. The question is this. When you say that the oil lasted for 8 days, does that mean was it burning all 8 days long? Or does it mean that it went out every morning and relit that night? You see the question?
So maybe it was only for 8 nights, not 8 full days.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because what is the rule with the Ner Tamid, right? The menorah?
24 hours.
No, it's not. The Ner Tamid is regular. It only burns during the night. Tamid in this case means it is repetitive, right? It's an ongoing light. But in fact, right, so this is actually what Leviticus requires. It's actually very interesting. The idea is that every morning it says Aharon should go in and he should actually light the lights in the morning, each day. Which means that the light is not burning meaning at the end of the day. The light is not burning during the day, it's only burning through the night. That's the point, right? Yeah. Make sense? And so the idea here is that means
cleaning out
there's
the ashes is holy.
What'd you say?
There's also a hechsher mitzvah for that.
Yeah.
Cleaning out the ashes.
Cleaning out the
holy
ashes. Cleaning out the ashes. Right, that's
blood.
Right. Well, we have lots of places where the ashes are cleaned, which is actually really, really fascinating. In any case, yeah, he cleans it out, and then he puts in new wicks and the whole thing. So that presumably the oil lasts for 8 days, but the wicks don't. You see what I mean by that? You have to put in new wicks every single day because presumably the wicks actually burn out. That means it's a new miracle every single day. And that's the way it's conceptualizing.
Why it's considered a miracle? The oil is already there.
Yeah, exactly right.
What is the miracle?
So presumably the idea is that the oil burns out that through the night. It burns out. And they take the same, you know, pach shemen, cruse of oil, and they pour from that oil anew each day.
There would be no oil, you wouldn't put the wicks.
Yes, that's exactly right. So presumably what you're doing is you're pouring the oil first and then putting the wicks in. Now, you're going to ask me about the, this is a much more typical Hanukkah shiur with a conservative rabbi is to show you that, in fact, the story of the oil is much more recent and that it's actually a celebration of originally Hanukkah is a celebration of the military victory, but that the rabbis were uncomfortable with that, and so they changed it to be a miracle of oil. So the reason I'm not entirely sure of that is because you actually do have a record of Hasmonean victory in rabbinic literature, namely in the Siddur. The Siddur does celebrate the Hasmonean victory very, very clearly. It does not mention the miracle of the oil, however. So the question is, what is going on in terms of the story of the oil in one place and the story of the military victory in the other? I think that the two things are going to be linked. I think that in Rabbinic imagination...
Between the rabbis and the leaders?
So I'm not so sure. That's what you would typically hear. I'm not sure that that's actually what's going on. Right. I think that that's a thing you will hear very commonly, not only from conservative rabbis, but from, you know, all liberal rabbis. You'll hear this because why? Because our values are that we abhor violence. Those are our values. You understand what I mean by that? And I think there are lots and lots of times we try to impose our values on rabbinic literature. Now,
so why Lag BaOmer? This is a violent situation.
I agree. That's exactly what I'm saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
That in fact, there are rabbis who supported the Bar Kokhba revolt. I'm not so sure, by the way, that Rabbi Akiva supported the Bar Kokhba revolt. I think that might be a little bit of a myth, based upon the fact that we don't have him supporting it in the Yerushalmi, but in fact, I think that there probably were a significant number of rabbis who were supporting revolt against the Romans, and I'm not so certain that the story about the oil is really an attempt to cover up the military victory. I think it's a much more complex story than that. I'm also not convinced that it's a glorification of violence either. I think it's a very complex story. I think it's nuanced. I think they're uncomfortable with the violence. But at the end of the day, I think that they do, in fact, adopt the idea, but with some discomfort. And I think that's probably what the story on the oil is.
Why did Rabbi choose the concept of miracle rather than physical victory or physical existence that there was an oil?
Well, the question is not was there a miracle? Everyone agrees there was a miracle. The question is, what was that miracle? Was the miracle the fact that you have this small group of people fighting a much larger and more equipped army and they managed to defeat them? Or was the miracle the fact that the oil lasted for a full 8 days of lighting and going out and lighting and going out and lighting and going out? And I think the fact that you have both of those listed as the miracle, right, when they're really two separate miracles, seems to indicate some kind of discomfort and contradictory feelings about what's actually going on in Hanukkah, right? That there is a kind of simultaneous celebration and discomfort with the being victorious over our enemies. Okay, so in any case, let's continue on here. So he's commanded us to light the lights of Hanukkah. What does he bless? He's commanded us to lahadlik ner shel Hanukkah. We've seen that before. So now we're going to ask the obvious question. So finish this out for us. And
what does he bless? He blesses who has sanctified us with the commandments and commanded us to light the light of Hanukkah.
Yeah.
And where did he command us?
Yeah, that's the question. Where did he command us? Well, okay, before you keep going here. So explain the question. What do you mean, and where did he command us? When I say, Asher kitchanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu, right, he was sanctified by his commandments and commanding us, what am I usually talking about?
A Torah verse.
That's exactly right. So give me an example of a case in which I say, Asher kitchanu b'mitzvotav, and there's a Torah verse that actually talks about that?
The Lulav and Eshek.
Perfect example, right? So in fact, right, the Leviticus chapter 24 tells me, right, Ulekachtem lechem b'yom harishon, that you should take on the first day, Eitz pri hadar, etc., 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 all these different kinds of trees and branches and things, and I'm going to take them all up, right? So, very good. So it's that verse to which I'm referring. By the way, I'm not sure that verse means that, but okay, fine, that's what the rabbis say. And in fact, there's a verse there that seems to prove it. Okay, so fine, so that's great. So then that's an example. I can give you other examples too, like tefillin. Right? I'm not sure exactly if that's really talking about tefillin also, but fine, the rabbinic tradition understands the verse is saying that. So fine, so there's another verse. Right? What's the verse? What in the world is the verse when it comes to Hanukkah candles? Right? Where has God commanded us with Hanukkah candles?
No, it's not.
Right here, it's in the Torah.
Right. So now we're going to talk about what we could be talking about, because it's obvious to them that in fact there's no place in the Torah where it explicitly says to light Hanukkah candles. Why? Because it wasn't Hanukkah yet at the time the Torah was given, right? Okay, so let's go ahead and hear the solution.
Where did he command us? Rav Avaya said, it's from Do Not Depart, Deuteronomy 17:11.
Mm-hmm.
Rav Nehemiah said, it's from Ask Your Father, and He will tell you, your elders, and they will say to you.
Mm-hmm. which is Deuteronomy 32:7. Okay, so Deuteronomy 17:11 says, "Lo tasur me asher yigidu lecha hashoftim v'hashotim asher yubiyamecha." Don't depart from what the judges and the officers in your day tell you to do. Right. So that is Deuteronomy 17. Deuteronomy 32 is essentially the same thing. There, it's actually talking about historically, right? This is the Ha'azinu, the great song of rebuke in Deuteronomy 32. If you don't believe that these things happen, just ask your elders. Of course, in this context, it means your elders are going to tell you what to do, and you have to do it, right? So either way, what this is saying is that there's a mandate from God to the rabbis to initiate, you know, sort of new practices. That's the idea.
Is it a Doraita mitzvah?
So that's the fascinating thing, right? What we've just done is we've made every rabbinic mitzvah into a biblical mitzvah. Right? That what happens is that if I violate a rabbinic mitzvah, I am actually violating a negative commandment. What's the negative commandment? Lo tasur, right? Don't turn away from what the rabbis in your day tell you to do. So every rabbinic mitzvah is also a biblical mitzvah. Now, you said before I was blurring lines. About rabbinic mitzvahs and biblical mitzvahs, I love to blur lines. You know this about me already. Things are much more complex than we think they are. There are times when the rabbis actually will claim that something is a biblical mitzvah when it's really a rabbinic mitzvah. I just gave you two of them, by the way, right? Probably in Leviticus 24, when they're talking about the lulav and the etrog, what they're really saying is take branches and then build the Sukkot, right? And probably with regard to tie them, what is it? It's ukshartam le'ot al yadecha, bind them as a sign upon your hands. Ukshartam le'ot al yadecha, b'hayu le'totofo b'ninecha. And they should be signs, they should be frontlets, whatever frontlets are, between your eyes. Probably that's a metaphor, right? Carry God next to your heart and between your eyes. That's probably the original meaning of it. Right? Shaviti Hashem le'negdi tamid. God should be in front of me at all times. So those are probably not biblical mitzvot. They're probably rabbinic mitzvot that actually have verses attached to them. You understand what I mean by that? Now, the rabbis conceptualize them as biblical, so they're d'oraita, right? So if you don't do them, then you're nullifying a mitzvah d'oraita, right? Again, what is biblical and what's rabbinic is not what's actually biblical and rabbinic. It's what the rabbis say is biblical and what the rabbis say is rabbinic. So I'll give you an example in the opposite direction. So you know about the sabbatical year. Every 7 years you let the land lie fallow. So the rabbis say, so that's explicit in the Torah, right? It's very, very explicit in the Torah. It's Leviticus chapter 25, I believe. No, 35, chapter 35. And what happens is the it's explicit there, and the rabbis say it's rabbinic. How can they say it's rabbinic? Doesn't the Torah say it? The Torah says it very explicitly. In fact, it's exactly the system that they use. The issue they say is there's no Jubilee year. If there's no Jubilee year, then the sabbatical year is rabbinic. Right, you have to have Kedushat Ha'aretz. The Jews have to be totally in control. There has to be like a functioning theocracy in the land of Israel. And if you don't actually have that kind of theocratic autonomy in the land of Israel, then there's no Jubilee year, and therefore there's no sabbatical year, and it's just a rabbinic mitzvah.
But you need to wait 49 years.
Well, so there's another problem there, is that there's a dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and about Rabbi Yossi about whether it's year 49 or it's year 50. Right? So, because the Torah is a little ambiguous. So, I don't know. Do you have to wait 49 years or do you have to wait 50 years? I can't tell you.
No, so, but you cannot, because you cannot ignore the 7 years, the third one, because you don't know what will be after 49 or 50.
Yeah. So maybe. But the point is, as long as there's not Kedushat Ha'aretz, as long as there's not a functioning theocracy in the land of Israel, there's no obligation to do it. That's really the point. That's, by the way, why the Rabbanut can say just sell the land. The reason they can say just sell the land is because it's a rabbinic mitzvah anyway. Yeah.
The Rav Kook made the deal with the kibbutzim.
Yeah.
To observe the...
Yeah, I know. It was very important to him. It was very important to him because at the end of the day, even though it's Durabanan, it's actually written in the Torah. Right? It's in Parshat Bahar. It's right at the end of the book of Leviticus. Okay. Anyway, let's keep going here. That's very interesting stuff, isn't it? That's really fascinating. Okay, so in any case, let's continue on here. What we're going to do is we're going to move over to Brachot. I want us to keep in mind, though, as we're moving along, that what we're looking at is we're looking at different modes of thanksgiving. We had this idea of miracle, right? We saw that in Brachot. When I encounter a place where something miraculous occurred from my ancestors, I make a bracha. And now it's pretty clear that bracha of Sha'asa Nisim Lavotenu Bayamim Hazeh Bazman Hazeh, who did miracles for ancestors at that time in this season, that's also a Birkat HaShavach. There are two brachot that are out of thanks, praise, whatever you want to call it, right? Okay, so now let's go on and we're going to see something additional, right? Now we're going to talk about Birkat HaGomel. So would you like to pick up?
Sure. Okay. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, four classes of people must offer thanksgiving. They who go down to the sea, who journey in the desert, the invalid who recovers, and the prisoner who has been set free.
Yeah, so these are the four categories of people that have to say Birkat HaGomel. And the way to remember that is the word chayim, chet yod yod mem, chavush, that first chet, is someone who is imprisoned, right, yisurin, is someone who is sick and then gets better, yam, is someone who goes overseas, and midbar, someone who goes through the wilderness. That's not the order that we have here. I'm going to talk about order in a second. So you could also say chola for the chet. So, but in any case, this is the acronym that they came up with. The Rambam has that acronym. We're actually going to have to talk about this order a little bit. We're going to see that this is all based on a psalm in a second. It's all based on Psalm 107. The order of these four categories is already biblical, right? In that they're there in the psalm. And we are also going to experience, I guess you would say, further confusion with the order, because the Rambam presents when he presents this material, he presents it in even a third order. There was a time I taught this material, I guess about 2 years ago, and I actually made out a chart of all of the different orders that we have these categories coming in these different texts. I could make nothing out of it. I really can't see any distinction or difference as to why they changed the orders. I don't really have a good explanation for it. So if you can come up with something and tell me why it is that the order shifts here and what the different orders are about, please let me know. I'd love to be able to sort of make heads or tails of why the orders switch around. But in any case, this is the order that they actually offer. Okay, so let's go ahead. So the first one is...
They who go down to the sea.
Yeah.
Whence have we this, for it is written...
Okay, so before we continue on, I'm going to skip the rest of this Gemara, and I'm going to go right to the Psalm. So if you go over onto page 5, you will see the whole of Psalm 107, and this actually is a much better way of dealing with this. What you can see here, if you look at the Psalm, the way I've got it set up, I've indented the four categories. And if you look, there's a refrain that changes slightly. There are two verses between each of these categories. So if you look, there's a short introduction. Verses 1 through 3 introduce the idea. Then starting in verse 4 through 7, we have the people who are traveling through the desert. Then in verse 8, you see on the next page, we have this refrain, "Let them praise the Lord for his steadfast love, his wondrous deeds for mankind." Right, which is Yodu Ladonai Chasto Miniflotav Livne Adam. Right, and then verse 9 is slightly different. Right, it's a bringing back of the idea. For he has satisfied the thirsty, filled the hungry with all good things. That second verse is going to change each time, and it's going to reflect what we just read. Right, because what's the fear of being in the desert? You're going to die of thirst and hunger. Do you see that? Okay, so now, in verse 10, what we have is we have the idea of prison. That continues through 14. Then again, in verse 15, here's the chorus again. Let them praise the Lord for his steadfast love, his wondrous deeds for mankind. Then in verse 16, we bring the idea back. For he shattered gates of bronze, he broke their iron bars. What were we talking about again?
Being in prison.
Good, okay. Now, verse 17, if you look at it, we actually have sickness, right? The sickness goes all the way through verse 20. And then we have the chorus again, verse 21, right? Let them praise the Lord for his steadfast love, his wondrous deeds for mankind. 22 is really interesting because it's talking about making sacrifices. Making sacrifices, we know. People make a korban shlamim after they get well from being sick. Right. What's the name of that? There's a specific name, by the way, that korban shlamim actually has. It's called a korban todah. When you bring a sacrifice after having been sick, you bring a thanksgiving sacrifice. There's actually a psalm we say in the mornings, Mizmor leTodah. That's probably a psalm that was recited over Thanksgiving sacrifices. And it's not said on the morning of Erev Pesach. You know why liturgically it's not said on the morning of Erev Pesach? Because you have to bring chametz with it. You have to bring a mincha offering, which is chametz. So you can't do that, so they don't say it on that day. It's really interesting. Okay, so fine. So in other words, we still have the idea of healing. Verse 21 is the chorus. 22 brings it back, and then of course we get the last one, which is the longest one, which actually talks about going to the sea, right? Very, very detailed description of a storm at sea, and then of course the chorus comes back again in verse 31, and then verse 32 all of a sudden seems to be an inclusive verse for all the categories. Let them exalt him in the congregation of the people, exclaim him in the assembly of elders. And just to talk about the structure of that verse 32, it's an A-B structure. This is very typical in Hebrew poetry. What you have is the first half of the verse talking about exalting him in the congregation of the people, and then an intensification. Acclaim him in the assembly of the elders. So it's not just amongst the people, but against the elite of the people that you're actually going to praise him. That's going to come back in the Talmud in a second. So, okay, so fine. So we've seen all of these things. The last piece here is just also a general sort of God saves us kind of set of verses. If you have a chance later to take this home, you can actually look at these descriptions. They are, in some cases, first-person descriptions of what the suffering of illness feels like, what the suffering of prison feels like, what the suffering of being and a storm at sea feels like. They're actually really extraordinary pieces. Okay, so now, going back to the Talmud itself, you'll see then, and I'm not going to have us read through all of this because we already read through it all, but if you look it's a different order, but if you look at it, they actually do have, this is what I meant by, I can't figure out what the hell is going on with the order, but you have here first those who go down to the sea, which is the last category in the psalm. Those who go down to the desert, which is the first category of the psalm. The invalid who recovers, which I believe was second, or maybe it was third. And the prisoner who set free, I think that one was the second one. And you can see they actually bring those verses in an abbreviated way, and they say those are the sources for all of those different kinds of thanksgiving. Okay. That is a huge amount of text that I just went through, and I talked about a lot of things there. I want to make sure that we're all still on the same page. I may have lost folks at this point. The point here is Psalm 107 is the source for what? Birkat HaGomel, right? In other words, it is the source for this business of reciting in synagogue this prayer, saying that God has saved me even though I'm not deserving of it. Now the question is, HaGomel l'chayavim tovot, right? Even though I really deserve punishment or maybe even death, God has saved me. Where does that come from? That also comes from the psalm. In each of these cases, if you look at the text, the reason that these people are being punished, right, or going through the suffering is because of their sins. It's because of their iniquities, right? This is the typical explanation for suffering that you have in the book of Psalms, right? I was sinful. God is punishing me, but he's being kind to me because things could have been much worse. I'm actually deserving of much worse things. Every mode of prayer exists in Psalms except for one. You know, the one kind of prayer that's missing from the book of Psalms? Complaint. Right? You get save me from my enemies, you get praise, you get request, right? You get thanksgiving, you get everything. The one thing you don't get is complaint. Why are you doing this to me, God? The one time that you come close to it is Eli, Eli, lama zivachtani, right? Why is it, O God, that you have abandoned me? But that's not a complaint. That's, I don't understand. There's a difference, right? Which is really very interesting. It's not, why are you doing this to me? I don't deserve this. Which I think is a much more Hasidic mode of prayer. And you have to wait until the 16th century to actually get that. That's a much, much later thing. Today, I think it's the most common mode of prayer, but that's a whole other story. Okay, so fine. So let us now continue on. Yes.
Why is it called Birkata Gomel, and why is that much absent from this?
Fantastic. So let us actually take a look at the end of the Gemara, because I wanted to actually show you this. So we're on page 4 here, where at the bottom of page 4 the paragraph starts, what benediction should be uttered. So you were reading this Gemara before, weren't you? So why don't you go continue?
What benediction should he utter? Rabbi Yehuda said, "Blessed, loving-kindness."
Now, in the fascinating thing about this is, if you look in the Hebrew, and this is in the printed editions of the Talmud also, it says Baruch Gomel Chasadim, right? Blessed is the one who bestows grace, right? Or loving kindness, or kindness, right? What is Chesed? Chesed is notoriously difficult to translate, but if you look at the words Gomel Chasadim, it's Gemilut Chasadim. Right? Right. The idea is Mahu Gomel Chesed, Afata Gomel Chesed, right? Just as God gives grace to those who don't deserve it, so too you should give grace and kindness to those who don't deserve it. Right? In other words, the act of Gemilut Chasadim is supposed to be a challenging act. It's not just that you're supposed to help the poor, that's tzedakah. Gemilut Chasadim means helping people who are sick, even though they're bastards. You understand what I mean? I don't mean mamzerim, or at least, or if I do mean it, then I mean it in the context, in the Yiddish colloquial context, and not in the technical halachic sense. In other words, people who are cruel and mean, you're supposed to help out too. Now you're going to say to me, "Wow, that sounds like a Christian concept, right?" But of course, the whole point is that the idea of grace is a Jewish concept. That's exactly what they're talking about. The only difference between the divine grace in Christianity and the divine grace in rabbinic Judaism is that you don't need a mechanism for divine grace in Judaism. Right? You're already in. Right? God already forgives your sins, and God does good things for you even though you don't deserve it. And that's what grace ultimately means. You don't have to have some kind of being washed in the blood of the Lamb in order to earn the divine grace. Grace is unearned. That's the whole point, right? Which is actually really interesting. It's a very interesting contradiction, internal contradiction in Christianity as well. Why do I have to earn grace by being justified through faith? It doesn't quite make sense. That obviates the whole point of grace. Right. Okay, so fine. So then, let us... Where were we? Oh, yes, this is the fascinating thing. How many rituals in Judaism do we have that require rabbis?
Very few.
Very few. In fact, there's only one I know of, and we're about to see it. So go ahead.
Rabbi said, "It is necessary for him to offer his thanksgiving in the presence of 10. For it is written, let them exalt him in the assembly of the people, etc. Marzotra said, 2 of them must be rabbis, as it is said, and praise him in the seat of the elders."
Oh my goodness, right? That's actually extraordinary. By the way, this is the halakha. Right? You are supposed to seek out 2 people, 2 individuals who are rabbis, or at least learned people, to be in the group of people who are going to respond to Birkat HaGomel. If you don't have that many, right, so fine. So you've still done it. But ideally, the best way of doing this is to actually have 2 rabbis who are actually present. Do you have 2 rabbis here on a Shabbos morning usually?
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yes, so there you go. So most shuls do. Right? So that's actually rather interesting. I can't think of any others. Can you think of any others? I really can't. I've been racking my brain. I can't think of any others that actually...
What is the reason you need 2 rabbis?
Right, so, okay, so if you look at verse, what verse was that? You remember, I pointed it out. It was verse 32, 107, Psalm 107, 32. It's on page 8. It's the second verse of the page on page 8. let them exalt him in the congregation of people, right? Vayiromamu hu bikal am. Kahal, how much is a kahal? How many people do you need to establish a kahal?
Ten
people, a minion, that's a kahal. Lesson that you don't have a kahal. If you have 10 people, you have a kahal. Okay, fine. So now, uvamoshav zikenim yahalaluhu. And also, in the assembly of elders, let him be praised. Right? So what does that mean? That means I have to have two zikenim. I have to have two sages. Right? So who are sages? Sages are rabbis. That's the whole point. It's actually really, really fascinating. It is really the only ritual I can think of that requires rabbis. Nothing else. So if you want to make the claim, so there are things that require kohanim, right? We know that there are things that require kohanim, right? So zilchening requires kohanim, pidyon haben requires kohanim. We have a number of different mitzvot that require kohanim. Those things are sacramental, right? If you want to think about it that way, they require priests. That's the whole point, right? So there's a so in fact, zilchening is. Birkat Kohanim is sacramental, if you want to think about it. That's the way a Catholic would talk about it. If it needs a priest, it's sacramental. The same thing's true of Pidyon HaBen. Pidyon HaBen is also sacramental. What I'm doing is I'm desacralizing the firstborn. It's there, right? That's also where the Catholics get it from, too, you understand. So then what do you have here? Is this sacramental or is this not sacramental? It's the only time I can think of where rabbis are really treated as clergy. Most of the time, rabbis are treated as judges. Not as clergy. This is really very interesting. You do need Beit Din for things. So, for instance, for conversion, you need to have Beit Din. But there, all three of them don't need to be rabbis. It's just three people who are qualified to serve on a court. Here you actually need rabbis, like ordained rabbis.
I just wanted to point out that Morty does teach at rabbinical school.
What about marriage?
No, you don't. You can have... All you need is someone who knows how to make a marriage, right? In other words, I have a good friend, Jonas Steinberg, who's actually the
Hillel director.
The Hillel director at Harvard, and he's not a rabbi. He has a PhD in Talmud. He's not a rabbi, but he does marriages all the time, right? So fascinating, right? Yeah. Zakain, yeah, so that's an interesting question. So Zakain, right? So Zakain, the Shivim Zakainim are these 70 elders who are always accompanying Moses around, right? They are, as far as the rabbis are concerned, the stand-in for the Sanhedrin, right? 70 elders, that's the point, right? These are rabbis. And in fact, you'll hear, so Hillel and Shammai, right? What are the titles? They don't have the title rabbi. What are their titles? Hillel HaZakein, Shammai HaZakein. Hillel the Elder, Shammai the Elder. This is the term that is used to mean rabbi before you have the term rabbi. What does rabbi mean, Rebbe or Rav?
Teacher.
Means master. Master, right? This is Eved V'Rabo, a slave and his master, right? And in fact, you have when Reish Lakish... Reish Lakish was a gladiator, and then he became a rabbi. I've heard this. Some of you have heard the story before. So when his friend and teacher, Rabbi Yochanan, insults him, he says, "What was the point of all of this? Right here, they call me Rav. Right, they call me boss. And there, when I was a bandit, they called me boss. So what's the difference? Right? And he uses the word Rav in both cases. It's actually really very interesting." Okay, so let's continue on here, and we're going to go back into the Gemara. We still got a little ways to go, so I think we're on page 5, right? Oh, no, we're at the bottom. We're still at the bottom of page 4. Go ahead. So Rav Ashi retorted.
Oh, right. Rav Ashi retorted, say that they must all be rabbis, but is it written in the...
It doesn't say, in other words, it doesn't say kahal's kenim, it says kahal am, right? It says, doesn't say in the assembly of elders, it says in the assembly of the people.
No.
Yeah, good.
No, it is written in the assembly of the people.
Yeah.
Then say, he must offer thanksgiving in the presence of 10 ordinary persons and 2 rabbis.
Right, now you see how that would work, right? Kahal am, right? You need to have a kahal, you need to have a minion, right, of regular people. And then Moshav's Kenim, you need to have two elders, so you need a total of 12 people. Fascinating idea, by the way, we're now replicating somehow the 12 tribes, I think, in some ways. This ends up being rejected, though. So go ahead.
The question remains unanswered.
Wow, so I guess it doesn't fully remain. It doesn't fully get rejected. But in any case, the halakha is simply that you need a minyan and two rabbis. Okay, so go ahead.
Rav Yehuda was ill and recovered. Rav Hana of Baghdad. And
yeah, where's Baghdad?
I assume it's in Baghdad.
That's right. It's in Iraq. In present day Iraq, this is where the Jews lived, right? Okay, so Rav Hana of Baghdad.
And other rabbis went in to visit him. They said to him, "Blessed be the Almighty who has given thee back to us and has not given thee to the dust."
Mm-hmm.
He said to them, "You have exempted me from the obligation of thanksgiving."
In other words, these rabbis go to visit him when he's sick, and they make this bracha, which is not the same bracha. Blessed is the one who's given you back to us and not given you to the dust.
He's recovered.
That's right. That's exactly right. And he says, they visit him on his recovery. You're correct. So then they're visiting him. Presumably it's a sick visit, even though he's recovered. Do you understand what I mean? So he says to them, "Oh, I don't have to say Birkat Hagoma." Right. This reminds you of what, by the way? We did this 2 years ago in here. Some of you were here for this, right? You've exempted me from saying Manish Tana. Right? The same kind of thing, right? What would you do if he says to his slave, Rabbi Eliezer says to his slave, what would you do if your master freed you and gave you great, great wealth? He says, "Oh, I would praise him." Says, you've exempted us from saying Manish Tana. Like, same kind of thing, which is really interesting. That seems cruel, though, but Well, we've talked about that before. Okay, apparently not. Yeah, which is actually really interesting. Okay, anyway, let us continue on here, please.
But Lo-Abiah said he must offer thanksgiving in the presence of 10. There were 10 present.
Okay, in other words, this is now Kushiyat Heirutz, I have a difficulty, and then I resolve it. Well, wait a second, doesn't he need a minion? Oh, there was a minion there. Okay, so fine, so go ahead.
But it was not he who uttered thanksgiving.
Right, who made the bracha in that story? Was it the one who was sick, who had recovered? Those rabbis visiting him. That's exactly right. It was not necessary.
It was not necessary because he responded amen after
that. So it is as if you say amen to the bracha, it's as if you've actually said it. What does amen mean, by the way? What'd you say? That's a later reading of the letters. Adonai Melech Ne'eman. God is a faithful king. What does the word amen really mean? What is it? It means, that's right. Yeah. Exactly right. Okay, so if I guess.
What was the motivation or the policy reason for finding that Psalms verse as the proof text for the need for rabbis?
Okay.
I assume there was some... It was sort of a rationale that led to that, as opposed to the other way around.
So you're saying, in other words, you're saying that the rabbis want themselves to be there at the time, right? Because they don't do it in other places, right? So it would be very easy for them to say you need to have rabbis in order to shecht an animal, or you need to have rabbis in order to perform a marriage. But they never say that kind of thing. But here, Dafka, they do say that you need to have rabbis. So I could give you like a very nice homiletic explanation. Oh, you need rabbis in order to be there for the person, right? Something like this. Of course, that rabbis aren't functioning pastorally in this period, probably either. If you want to ask me what's going on, really, I think that there is a need on the part of the people to have someone there as a stand-in for God. I think that's actually what's going on. I think that's what goes on in all sacraments. That you need to have someone there who is the channel or the stand-in for God. And apparently the rabbis are convinced it can't just be one rabbi who's a stand-in for God, because that's not sufficient. It has to be some kind of a group of rabbis. This probably relates back to, there's a series of texts in Brachot that actually talk about where is the divine presence. Right? The divine presence is in Minyan. Right? That's where you get it. But what's their final answer? Right? Their final answer is you need to have at least two people who are learning together, two people in Talmud Torah. Now, at the very end, they say, well, maybe even one person if they're reciting Mishnayot. But in this particular case, it's the presence of the two rabbis who are apparently learning that actually brings divine presence.
What
I think that's what's going on.
Sacramental purposes, is not
Kohanim. Yeah, so that's a great question also. That's a great question also, which feels like it should be, you're right. But what does the psalm say? Does the psalm say B'moshav Kohanim? Or B'moshav Kedoshim? It says B'moshav is a Kanim.
I mean, that's assuming that the practice follows from the psalm.
Right. In this particular case, since psalms are not part of, or are not restricted like rabbinic tradition is, do you know what I mean by that? In other words, the psalm itself is something that all Jews have access to. I suspect what's going on here, and I have no proof of this, but I suspect, you know, sort of, and this is just a supposition, that in fact there was an organic practice that arose as the result of this psalm, and that people started practicing this way, and they wanted to have rabbis present because there was a need for a kind of a clergy class. And this really, I think, to some extent is the beginning of the rise of rabbis as a clergy class. And I don't think it comes from the rabbis. I think it comes from the people. Now, the fascinating thing about this is we're going to see this replicated in Christianity in just a second. We're going to see this same idea of Psalm 107 replicated in amongst English Christianity and then amongst the pilgrims as well. It's actually really fascinating. Psalm 107 becomes what is recited at Thanksgiving and in the United States. And we'll see how that happens in a little bit. But in any case, let's talk about Hallel now before we get to that last piece. What time am I going to, by the way? I have an hour and a half, right?
Right.
So I have another 25 minutes, something like
right.
that? Right. Good. I want to leave some time for questions. So let's do this. Let's go ahead and we'll move over one more and we'll take a look at... this is a fascinating text. We're not going to get to read all of Arachin. I recognize it's a very long text. Why is it a very long text? Because it goes through every single festival on which the Hallel is recited. And what I might do is I'll start us out reading this, and I'm going to summarize a little bit what's going on, and then we'll go to Hanukkah, and we'll look specifically what it says about Hanukkah. Okay, so please, we're moving down the line here. Sir?
Oh.
Yes, what's your name?
Reed.
Oh, Reed? Yes. Okay, fine. My wife's name is Esther Reed. And she got this in school all the time. The teacher would say, Esther, read. Yeah, so go ahead.
Rabbi Yochanan?
Yeah.
In the name of Rabbi Simeon ben Yehoshua Zak?
Yeah.
There are 18 days on which an individual completes the Hallel, 8 days of the Feast of Sukkot,
mm-hmm.
the 8 days of Hanukkah, the first festival day of Pesach, and the festival day of Shavuot.
Good.
In the exile...
Yeah.
One praying in the Jewish completes the Hallel on 21 days. The 9 days of Sukkot, the 8 days of Hanukkah, the 2 festival days of Passover, and the 2 festival days of Shavuot.
Okay, good. Completes the Hallel. Meaning, those are the days when you really say Hallel. Okay? The way that this is conceptualized in the rabbinic tradition is that there is a mitzvah to say Hanukkah, to say Hallel on these 18, or in the diaspora, 21 days. On the other days when you say the half Hallel, that is a custom. And in fact, the way that this actually plays itself out in Halakha is that, okay, so I'll say it this way. Maimonides says you always say Hallel as an individual, like if you're davening at home, on the days when you complete Hallel. But on the days on which Hallel is a half Hallel, the individual at home doesn't say Hallel, according to Maimonides. The way this actually plays itself out in Halakha today is that the custom is the individual always says the half Hallel. But if they're at home, they don't make the bracha. That's actually how it plays itself out. It's actually really, really, really fascinating. I think these fine, fine distinctions in halakha, sometimes they seem like, what the hell is going on? Like, who cares? What's actually going on is it's like, have you ever been in like a really old house and they have like this weird cabinet in like this weird location or this corner that's very strange, and it like used to be part of the butler's corner, sort of what do they call that? The butler's
pantry.
Butler's pantry that no longer exists because the house has been remodeled, but there's this vestige left over. Do you know what I'm talking about? So it's the same kind of thing here. We have a really, really old religion, and it's like living in a really, really old house. And so what happens is you get these weird quirks that come into the religion, not because people are actually making these kinds of like really fine distinctions or going like this. It's because it developed organically, and they had to come up with the reason for it afterwards. Right? So my grandfather always said this. I think he's absolutely right. They come up with the custom first and the explanation later. Right. The goal of Talmudic philology, which is, you know, sort of the enterprise that we're engaged in, is actually to try and figure, well, what might actually have been the reason. It's a kind of cultural archaeology where we're trying to figure out, oh, actually there was a butler's pantry there. Right. Okay. So fine. So let's go ahead and see what happens here. So if you look and then at the next paragraph, I'm not going to read through the next paragraph, there's a discussion here about what's going on in terms of the distinction between Sukkot and Pesach. And what happens in the distinction between Sukkot and Pesach is on Sukkot, each day the sacrifices change. You know, you start out with 13 bulls, right, then you go down to 12 bulls, then you go down to 10 bulls, you wind up with a total of 70. The way this works is on the last day of Sukkot, you have 7 bulls. First day is 13, last day is 7, that's a total of 20. Right, second day is 12, second to the last day, the penultimate day, is 6. Right, so you put them together, 18. You keep going like this, and you wind up with a total of 70. It's a really interesting pattern. On Pesach, however, each day it's the same sacrifice every single day, which is actually really interesting. What's going on here is that somehow Hallel is linked to the sacrifices. Hallel would not have been recited in the temple because you only recite Hallel when you have a new sacrifice that changes. And since on Pesach it doesn't change, then they would not have recited Hallel. That's why there's a half Hallel during those days on Passover. The question they ask is about, well, wait a second, what about Shabbat Chol HaMoed? There the sacrifices actually do change. And the answer there is no, it's not a Moed. The whole point of why you're reciting Hallel is because it's actually a festival, and there's no festival here. So then the question is, well, what about Rosh Chodesh? Why do we not do it on Rosh Chodesh? Right, and the answer is that Rosh Chodesh is also not a festival. Right, there's no prohibition of work on Rosh Chodesh, and so therefore you don't actually recite Hallel. So now here's a really 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 good one. I think I actually am going to read this one, or actually have Reed read this one. If you look at the middle paragraph on page 13, the question is then asked. Well, wait a second.
10.
Oh, page 10. I'm sorry, page 10 out of 13. Reed, if you look at this middle paragraph here, the question is asked, and it's a really good question. Well, why shouldn't we say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? Those are days that are a festival, and the sacrifices change, right? So now look at this. This is tremendous. Go ahead and read it for us out loud.
And let the Hallel be said on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, both of which are called festival and are sanctified by the prohibition of labor. That is not possible because of Rabbi Abahu, for Rabbi Abahu said, the ministering angels said before the Holy One, blessed be He, why do not the Israelites sing a song before you on the New Year and on the Day of Atonement? He answered them, would that be possible? The king sits on the throne of judgment with the books of those destined to live and destined to die before him. Israel singing a song before
me? Right, so fantastic. So this is an Agadic, obviously, passage. There are lots of times in the Talmud, more times than you would be aware of, than you would think, I should say it that way, that halakha is actually determined by some kind of a narrative or a mythological kind of understanding of things. Here, the better way, the way that we could conceptualize this is as a psychological reason. People aren't ready to say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. They're too freaked out. It's not emotionally the right time to say Hallel. This is not a time when we can give thanks. This is not a time when we can give praise. We're too nervous and freaked out, right? And there needs to be a different emotional tenor for Thanksgiving to be given. And so therefore, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur don't have that aspect of what I'm calling Thanksgiving. I know I'm blurring categories, but you understand what I mean, right? Okay, so
far. Because, in fact, we have, you know, the whole Malchuyot section is all about praising God.
That's true.
Acknowledging his kingship.
That's exactly
what the whole day is about.
That's right. So the fascinating thing about Hoda'ah, right, the todah, that root, it doesn't, you know, I talk about semantic ranges sometimes, right? So when you try and translate words from Hebrew into English, or from English into Hebrew, for that matter, from any language to any other language, there's no one-to-one correspondence. Words in different languages have a different semantic range. They encompass different meanings. Some are smaller, and some are larger. And sometimes we'll use a word that has a smaller range of meaning to translate a word that has a larger range of meaning. So, for instance, mahodot in Hebrew, right? It means both to thank and to acknowledge. And in certain circumstances, it can mean to thank, and in certain circumstances, it can mean to acknowledge, because the semantic range is larger than the word thanks or the word acknowledge in English, which is actually... What did you say?
Spelled differently, not the same word.
The root is either hey dalid hey or hey dalid yud. It doesn't really matter. As you know, the last of those three radicals in Hebrew, when you actually have a triliteral root, can be a hey, a yud, or a vav. In those, it's just a weak end. It doesn't really matter. It's all the same. It's all the same thing. Hoda'ah and hodayah. It's the rabbinic form versus the biblical form.
Like when we say
modima nasnulah. Modima
nasnulah. Like acknowledgement.
Right, exactly right. It means both acknowledgement and thanks. It means both things together. What did you say?
Modima nasnulah would be thanking.
Right, so I think...
I don't think so. Shatahu Adonai Eloheinu.
That's right. Modima nasnulah shatahu Adonai Eloheinu.
Yes.
But the point I am making is it is all of those things simultaneously. You can't do that in English. If you actually look in the Sim Shalom, the way that Harlow translated it is, we gratefully acknowledge. Right? Why? Because he's trying to encompass both. He's really trying to encompass both because he's sensitive. He's sensitive to the fact that the word lehodot means both to thank and also to acknowledge. And that's what's going on there. And it's really hard to translate. You have to use two words to translate it. And that's the point, right? And so that's actually what's going on here. I think that the reason that in Malchuyot, what's going on, the reason we don't use the word modeh ever in Malchuyot, what do we say? We say, Aleinu l'shabeach ladon hakol, right? We need to praise, and we use shavach. We don't use hoda'ah or hodayah, if you prefer. I think that's very purposeful. It's very purposeful. Okay, let us continue on about Hanukkah, which is really the basis of what we're actually doing here, and I'm going to end really soon here. But there on Hanukkah.
There is Hanukkah, which neither one nor the other condition applies, and the Hallel
is set. Right, in other words, you don't have, it's not a festival, work is not forbidden, right? It is, the word Mo'ed isn't there, there's just nothing. But nonetheless, we say the full Hallel. So what's the answer?
As due to the miracle.
Okay, now, here's the problem. Purim has a miracle, too. You don't say Hallel on Purim. They go through a whole rigmarole to get there. But finally, what they end up saying is that, in fact, the Megillah is the Hallel for Purim. It's actually really, really fascinating. And that's where we end up. So what is this whole journey about? The whole journey here was about the fact that when you have all of these different brachot, what they're all designed to do is they are designed to create a grateful acknowledgement of God for salvation that is undeserved. And they all are variations on a theme. The fact of the matter is, all of this meaning that we have, that we've seen from all of these various circles and cycles, is contained in two brachot in two liturgical practices on Hanukkah. One liturgical practice is Sha'asa Nisim Lavotenu Bayamim Haim Bazman Hazeh, right? We actually thank God for having done miracles for our ancestors in those days, in this season. And then simultaneously with Hallel, right, we just saw it. What is Hallel about on Hanukkah? It's about the miracle. It's about the miraculousness of the miracle. just to say this very, very briefly, the Rabbanut Reshit in 67 actually issued an edict after the chief rabbinate, right? Excuse me, thank you. I said it in Hebrew, didn't I? The chief rabbinate in Israel actually issued an edict after the 67 war that that on Yom Yerushalayim, on the day of the reunification of Jerusalem, a full hallel with a bracha should be said, which means they thought it was what? It was a miracle. It was a miracle, right? It was miraculous. The divine hand was involved in the victory in the 67 war, and that's actually an incredible declaration that they made. Now, I want to show you something else that's actually really fascinating, and then I'm going to have you read this, and this will be the last piece. Ma'am, would you care to read the very last piece on the very last piece? This is from Nick Bunker. I couldn't pick his book. He has a very long book where he actually brings this information in a much longer way, but I actually took it from the piece he wrote for the Daily Beast back in 2010.
If you were English and you wish to express gratitude to God, you would turn to one majestic biblical text before any other. It speaks about the wilderness of the Sinai, about danger and deliverance, about the journey of the Israelites across the Red Sea, and about the duty to give thanks when the Exodus is complete. The text is Psalm 107. In the reign of Elizabeth I, when the realm survived a plot, a plague, or the Spanish Armada, her subjects went to church and gave thanks to the Almighty, using the same song, "We will offer unto him the sacrifice of thanksgiving and tell out his works with gladness." Mm-hmm. So, at Provincetown, when the Mayflower first dropped anchor in 1620, the pilgrims did likewise. For them, the psalm possessed a still deeper resonance. Keen scholars of Hebrew, which they saw as the original language of God, the pilgrims knew that Psalm 107 was the source of the Jewish Thanksgiving prayer, the Birkat HaGomel. They owned books by an English scholar, Henry Ainsworth, who used the Jewish word for Maimonides to show that this was so. The Birkat HaGomel was the prayer that every devout Jew should say upon safe arrival after a dangerous voyage. The pilgrims said it too. And so in New England, the pilgrims took a variety of sources, and over time they blended them together to create their early thanksgivings. Their successors did the same. They said thanksgiving psalms like the Jews. Sometimes they fasted and sometimes they ate and drank, and like their British cousins, they puffed themselves up with national pride. Centuries later, Americans ended up with a hybrid of Elizabethan patriotism, Algonquin fun and a dash of non-denominational piety. In other words, the modern Thanksgiving. All you need add is Psalm 107 to make the events of life.
Right. That's tremendous, right? It's really tremendous, really tremendous. And the other thing about this, of course, is that Sukkot is in some ways the original Jewish Thanksgiving. Remember, Hanukkah is conceptualized, as I started out saying, by 2 Maccabees as a replacement for Sukkot. So we have two Thanksgivings in the year. We have Sukkot and we have Hanukkah, and right smack dab in between them we have the American Thanksgiving, which is really just tremendous. Really just tremendous. Yes.
The dates of Hanukkah, when they were established and how they were established?
The 25th of Kislev? Yeah, the 25th of Kislev is probably the actual date that the temple was retaken by the Maccabees, by the Hasmonean, the small Hasmonean force. Why do they then pick 8 days? Probably because if you look at the dedication of the tabernacle in the book of Leviticus, it's 8 days long. And they are rededicating the temple. This is also the length of time that Solomon establishes the temple, is 8 days. And that's also the amount of time that Ezra and Zerubbabel used for their... Yeah, is 8 days.
8 days. The definition of Hanukkah.
8 days. But the 25th, because that's the day they could get in and start. I think Christmas is probably the 25th of December after Hanukkah. In other words, I think that they probably picked the 25th as the date of Christmas because Hanukkah was already the 25th of the month.
Oh, 8 days before the Brit Milah of Jesus.
That's exactly right. So New Year's is Sylvester, right? It's the feast of the circumcision.
Right.
So as we all know, you know, the circumcision is more, the bris is more important than the birthday. So this, and by the way, this is the name day. Right, you know, the name day was always what was celebrated in medieval Europe instead of the birthday. Birthdays only start being celebrated in the late 18th, early 19th century. Before that, everybody celebrating their name day, the day they were named. Yeah.
Morty, why do you think Hanukkah, and you can add Purim to the mix, why do you think those miracles were set aside and sort of glorified as events that deserve this level of thanksgiving?
You mean like why not Yom Nicanor?
Well, yeah. many Jews thought miracles happened often.
Yeah.
The literature reflects that sort of miracles happened all the time.
Yeah.
What do you think led to, you know, Hanukkah?
And Purim.
Yeah. Purim, though, was the sort of saving of the entire people from annihilation.
Yeah.
Particularly if the miracle here is something about candles lasting, you know, oil lasting for 8 days.
Yeah.
Why was that glorious?
So there's a text that we have from the Second Temple period, which is a proto-rabbinic text called Megillat Ta'anit, and it actually lists all of these fast and feast days. It's actually the days on which one is not allowed to fast. And Hanukkah and Purim are listed there, but a whole bunch of holidays are listed there. I mentioned one of them, Yom Nicanor, which is the day on which the doors for the Second Temple were in Herod's temple were actually put up. What had happened is they dropped in the sea on the way to Israel. They'd been ordered special from Alexandria, and then they washed up on the beach, so they were actually able to use them. They thought they were lost, and then they actually were able to use
them. That's a big miracle.
That's a great miracle, right? So then why is that eliminated and these things are kept? And the answer seems to be that all of these other things are actually related to the physical space of the temple. Now, you can make the argument that Hanukkah is also, but probably Hanukkah is was conceptualized as a military victory, and it was the beginning of the origin of the Hasmonean dynasty. And Purim is obviously not connected to the temple at all. So when the Talmud says Batla Megillat Ta'anit, right, the scroll, the fasting scroll has been nullified, right? They mean all of those other festivals, the 2 days that they say haven't been nullified, are Purim and Hanukkah. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is they're a lot of fun, and people kept doing them.
Because
ancient solstice things that they were trying to...
Well, they're that, too. The problem is that it's not quite the Tikufa, right? It's not quite the solstice days. And the solstice days are actually the two solstices and the two equinoxes are actually listed in Megillat Ta'anit also as festival days. They're days on which you bring wood into the temple and you restock the supplies, I guess you would say, for the ongoing fire on the altar. So they're there. They're also linked, by the way, the solstices and the equinoxes are also linked to Purim and Pesach very explicitly. So those are much more celebrated, I guess. The winter solstice, yeah, probably in its origin. It's a light festival, and Purim is also a late winter drinking festival, which lots of peoples have as well. So yeah, it's those things as well, but it's also probably because it's a popular
the miraculous nature of Purim, Hanukkah, and Pesach, what they share in common,
yeah,
is actually the saving of the people physically.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the military victory, one would think, it's been perpetuated, the memory of it.
Yeah.
Because that would rise to the level of something sufficient to say Hallow.
Yeah, I actually think you could make the argument that the same thing happens on Sukkot, right? Sukkot is about the protection, the divine protection of these sheltering of the sheltering presence, the divine presence. Right? Certainly how the rabbis conceptualize of it, that it's Ananei HaKavod, right? It's the divine presence that you see throughout the Torah itself. Yeah?
There's no danger.
It's the same desert. It's the desert. It's the desert. It's the wanderings. Hiva Sukkot Oshatim Yisrael, right?
Desert
wandering. No, it's not discrete. There isn't a strong narrative. You're absolutely right. The fascinating thing, though, is, of course, why is it that Shavuot does not have a narrative associated with it in the Torah. We give it the narrative of Matan Torah. But it's obvious that it's Matan Torah, because if you look at of the giving of the Torah, because if you look at chapter 20 of Exodus, it's really, really clear that the Torah is being given either on the 6th or 7th of Sivan. You actually do the math, and it actually comes out, it works out the right way. And so the question is, well, why don't they make that explicit? Why is it implicit in the Torah? I have my own theories about that, but that's for another time.
Morty, say something about the celebration of Hanukkah in the Yerushalmi and Birkat HaGomel in the Yerushalmi.
Well, so that's very interesting. So first of all, the brachot for Hanukkah don't appear in the Yerushalmi, which is actually really, really very interesting. Although the same discussions that you have in the Mishnah about Hanukkah do appear in the Yerushalmi. So, for instance, if a camel walks through the marketplace and someone has their Hanukkah lamp going, and the camel has flax on its back, and then the flax lights up and the camel carries fire through the marketplace and things get burned up, the person's not liable because the camel owner should have known, right? In other words, the shop owner isn't liable, the camel owner is liable, because he should have known it's Hanukkah. You have to be careful with your animal when you're going through the marketplace, right? So that's there. Bikurim is there as well, that you can bring first, this is another connection with Sukkot actually, you can bring your first fruit up until Hanukkah. When Sukkot hits, you stop saying Arami Oved Avi, but you can still bring it. It's sort of like a grace period. If you can think about taxes, right? You have to pay your taxes by X date, but there's a grace period afterwards, right? So you can get your Bikurim, you have to bring your Bikurim by between Shavuot and Sukkot, your first fruits. But then if it takes until Hanukkah, you're still okay. Something like that. So there are a number of things like this, but you don't have the explicit kinds of rituals here. It's all, you'll notice here, it's all Babylonian rabbis too, which is actually really, really interesting. They were probably lighting candles in Eretz Israel, lighting lights, I should say, in Eretz Israel, but they were, but they probably were not making brachot.
I mean, I've heard it suggested that potentially the issue is that they did not want to ascribe a Sherkid Shana B'Mitzvot Avit Sivanu and have the dialogue about Deorite, the mitzvah, Torah, Edik mitzvah for Hanukkah in the Yerushalmi, and therefore posited that, like with the Shabbat candles we were talking about, they were lighting these lamps for this historical memory, but did not want to get it to the level of actually saying it's mitzvah.
Right. I think there needs to be more work done in general about the way that Birkot HaMitzvot actually work in the Yerushalmi. I don't think they work the same way that they work in the Babylonian Talmud. I think that there's a difference, right? We always think of lighting Shabbos candles as having a bracha associated with them, right? And like there's all this resonance. Was it the Schindler's List? That was the central ritual, right? That they chose to highlight because it's this great symbolic ritual. But of course, the bracha is probably a much more recent innovation. It's not in either Talmud. It's actually really, really fascinating. Yeah.
So, incredible learning again. Talmudic takes on the holidays continues near Pesach. I want people to know about a couple of things. First of all, God willing, Morty's book will come out soon, and we'd love to throw you
I know you're
going to have at JTS, but God willing, here too, a little bit of a launch and a sharing your book with us in addition to your Talmudic take on Pesach. Secondly, I think people should know that Morty, in addition to teaching and running the Beit Midrash for rabbinical students at the seminary, heads up a really unique program kind of in our four columns of the world, as opposed to Yeshivat Hadar, which is an egalitarian yeshiva that works, or Drisha, where men and women have been learning Talmud, women learning Talmud. Morty started, he took over a program that was just in its infancy, but really has grown it already at the seminary during the summer called Nishma. And it is a program where adults at beginning level, intermediate level, and more advanced levels can spend weeks studying with scholars we've had here, friends of ours. Rabbi Eliezer Diamond teaches an advanced course. Those of you who have studied with other JTS scholars would recognize some names. And this is for budding scholars who are learning about rabbinic text, and it's also for those who have literacy developed over years, like many in our community, who have been studying Talmud in different locations and in different organizations. But when you get to study with Morty and with some of the folks over at the seminary through his program, it's a treat, and he's building it, and it's on the rise. adult learning is taking off. Our continued commitment as a community to that really has, I think, inspired some at the seminary to see the great desire and need for it in the community. We continue our classes here with scholars from the seminary, and also there's this opportunity during the summer I just wanted to throw out there, because it can feel like almost like a sabbatical during the summer to actually commit yourself to Jewish learning in a program like this, a stay-home sabbatical of a sort, to really say, I'm going to be in the Beit Midrash all day, every day, and I'm sure Morty can tell you more about it. So yishar koach, thank you for sharing your wisdom with us, Morty.
Thank you for mentioning the program. That was really tremendous.
Sweet, happy Hanukkah, full of light, with blessings.
Amen, amen, amen.